Thank you very much, and thank you to CEDA, our distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Let me pay my respects to the Noongar people and their elders, past and present. Translating ECEC research into positive and sustainable practice is probably the biggest challenge we have in Australia, and indeed other countries, as you've probably been aware. However, there has been widespread recognition that, as well as development taking place even before the first breath is breathed, we've helped to lay positive foundations for most of our citizens. Yet those who need it most, those born into disadvantaged families, are the least likely to participate in any form of early childhood learning and care. But, you know, we have to have a message of hope. And that message is that we provide appropriate opportunities, we can not only help our children secure their best chance for a productive and healthy life, but we can run a parallel process that gives a second chance to their parents through a model of dual generational learning. And ultimately, we can get greater participation through the message of social inclusion. Now, I'm not going to give you any great metrics from research, except one very powerful one given the GFC, and that is C.D. Howe several years ago showed that if we were able to increase the literacy of our nation by 1% against the international average, that would ultimately translate into a 2.5% increase in productivity, and that would come back to a 1.5% increase in your pocket in the GDP. So that's my economic message to you. But it was Nelson Mandela who said that there can be no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way it treats its children. And I just want to show that it's very interesting how we've put different lens from a global perspective on the well-being of our children in society over a long period of time, with progressive paradigms of social, economic and demographic development. So, you can see we've moved through what might be called the survival paradigm of the 18th century, focused on the physical health of children in a period that was rife with disease, through to moral consideration in terms of how they might be raised, debates about the protection within and outside the family home, prioritising their psychological development with increasing visibility of mental health within our society. But it was between 1960s and 1980s that we saw the shift to reflect the recognition of social inequities as a factor behind the development of children in a differential way, culminating in 1989 with the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child, and the idea that all children in all settings are entitled to the standards of care and protection enshrined within. So if you look at the contemporary focus on early childhood that emerged firstly in the 1990s with the seminal research of the neuroscientists such as Jack Shonkoff and Clyde Hertzmann, they raised an awareness of the ecological impact of the child's family and community environment on their healthy intellectual and physical development. This discourse paralleled, of course, and we sometimes forget this, the breakdown of the nuclear family structure, the rise of the lone parent family, and today they would constitute beyond 20% of our population in terms of families. As this forum demonstrates, the emphasis has shifted over recent times to the economic paradigm and an interest in the capacity of quality ECEC to contribute to the national economic prosperity through a skilled workforce. Now, I think we have to combine all those lenses and look at the child through all of those particular paradigms, because that's the only way we're going to bring about social inclusion and the participation that we need from all our citizens, whether they're disadvantaged in terms of their background or not. But let me quickly take you back. The Smith family decided way back in 1999 that the biggest issue surrounding Australia in terms of our low socioeconomic peoples was the fact that they were being left behind, and particularly our children, with a focus from 1922 onwards to what are the big issues surrounding our children. We decided we had to go through a massive, major transformation to meet the challenges that we could see looming. And for us, it was moving from a welfare-oriented organisation to one that was generating real societal change, ensuring that intergenerational transmission of disadvantage was broken. The term social inclusion was not in our lexicon at the time, so we talked about social change. And indeed, education wasn't accepted back in 1999, that something like the Smith Family, an organisation that was here for the disadvantaged, should just concentrate on education. But that is what this organisation that I represent, the Smith Family, saw. If we don't concentrate, focus, turn the research evidence into practice and ensure that we walk the walk, walk the talk, etc., etc., with our people, we weren't going to see anything very much different. And as I said, we had seen the increase in lone parent families. 700,000 children were living in jobless households, and the figure's not much better today, I have to say. There was a sense of a loss of belonging, a feeling that we belonged to a community. And of course, our social capital was being degraded. If you looked at the economics of Australia, where were the skilled workers going to come from? If not from a population of well-educated people who were cared from a very early age. So back in 1999, we set off on our journey. And there were a number of guiding principles that we used back then, but I'm just going to concentrate on the three in red, that we should, as a national social independent enterprise, be about societal change, work with and through others, and move steadily along the continuum of change to the prevention early intervention end. Now, a number of facts underpin these principles. The first, that social inclusion is the societal change we're seeking, and it came about, we felt, from a combination of a broader vision of a more caring and cohesive Australian community and our more immediate mission of unlocking opportunities through education. Second, this is not something that can be achieved by any one organisation or institution acting in isolation. We knew that it requires to focus on building change outside of the organisation. Back in 1999, few within our sector shared or understood this perspective. Indeed, some of my board members wondered why I was doing something that amounted to putting in place a social movement of change rather than just concentrating on the organisation. But an article in the fall of 2007 from the Stanford Social Innovation Review clearly summed it up, and in these words I think I would concur. Becoming a high impact non-profit is not just about building a great organisation and then expanding it to reach more people. Rather, high-impact non-profits work with and through other organisations and individuals outside themselves to create more impact than if they did this alone. So we were talking in that stage, and we still talk, about social movements transforming business, government, other non-profits and individuals. And in doing so, we work together to change the world around us. And third, it was very important that we needed to rebalance our limited resources as an organisation to focus on the early stages of life. What I now want to move on to, as we've worked through our particular research policy practice paradigm, we've really tried to ensure that we get down to the prevention end to stop the gaps forming in the first place. And we can do that if we're able to afford our disadvantaged kids the opportunities to get the skills and confidence to successfully transition from home to school, for example, on a par with their advantaged peers. We looked at our guiding principles and we looked at what we were going to do in two forms. The DNA, we call it, of the Smith family composes of the participation, that side where we're trying to unlock opportunities through education for our disadvantaged kids. But for us, social inclusion is not the same as social exclusion. If we were talking about social exclusion, we'd be talking about the participation agenda. But for social inclusion, the haves, if you like, in society have to change as much as the have-nots. And that's where we've got an engagement strand connecting those with time, talent and dollars to come together. In this case, we've got a suite of programs called Learning for Life, and we're trying to connect up people from one side with the other, if you like. And in doing so, we bring about social inclusion. In the student years, a cascade of relationships may start with a base level, a financial scholarship. And for example, what I'm talking about in terms of connection, that puts a sponsor in contact with the student or the student in contact with the sponsor. Then we can move on to a mentor and mentee, tutor, tutor. Whether you're talking about our youth or you're talking about refugees who need to connect up with English language tutors. So for us, what we've been about for 10 years now is the first part of social inclusion in action, connecting different people in different ways to overcome what has seemingly been the intractable problems or indeed emerging social issues. But it's important for us to look and say you've got to connect both the supply and demand sides if you're going to build the capacity of the excluded and the receptivity or connectivity of the included. So in this next 10 years, we have a new national framework, and what we have been doing over the last 10 years is building up the capacities, the skills and capacities of our disadvantaged kids on Learning for Life suite of programs. Obviously, we're trying to ensure the successful transition points along the horizontal axis there, and we have a number of programs. But it's not good enough. If you look at getting kids ready for school, there's the corollary of getting schools ready for the kids. So these settings are on the vertical axis. Look at the settings that you would normally find the kids, whether you're talking about home, community, the educational institution, starting from preschool and going right through, or the workplace. The issues there revolve around how can we make those settings much more attractive and able to build those capacities for our kids. What are the relationships that are formed in these various settings? What are the key relationships? Obviously, it's parent and baby, or carer and baby. Then in the school years, obviously, the teacher and the student peer-to-peer, etc., etc. It is vitally important that we look at the relationships, because there's a saying that the poor remain poor because they only know poor people. Think about that for a while. We say that the 21st century is all about relationships, and I think Charles Leadbetter, who was an advisor to Tony Blair, has summed it up beautifully here when he said, "We know this is just common sense, but sometimes someone has to say it for you to really accept it. Children learn when they have the right relationships. Those relationships make them feel cared for, give them recognition for who they are, where they've come from, and what they've achieved, motivate them to learn, engage them to be participants in their own learning." Now, what the Smith family did was to go over a period of time building up what we needed to do in the early years. In 2001, we started a pilot, Parents as Teachers, in partnership with the New South Wales Department of Education and Training. And what we were trying to do was, from early pregnancy in the home setting, help the parents to understand how they interacted with their child. In 2002, we then started another pilot with the University of Newcastle, Shells supported Home for Early Languages and Literacies. And it was interesting when we were hearing about science, what we were doing here was saying if parents have to, on a daily basis, go about their normal chores, they can turn it into a learning experience. If you're having problems, for example, in the supermarket with your child yelling or your children yelling and wanting the lollies to go into your tray, what you might do is take them over and show them an orange and then do a little experiment with them, and then when they go home they can even taste the orange and understand what the juice is. There's always a learning opportunity, and that gets you through your chores as well as help the kids learn and understand emergent literacy and to quell some of the anxiety that you might feel as a parent. Then we took a major step in 2003 with the Centre for Community Child Health in Victoria. We set in train a program called Let's Read. This starts at 4 months and it's an emergent literacy program. And it's really trying to get kids and their families to understand the importance of the love of books and to understand the name of letters and to play with the sound of words, etc. Now, the success of Let's Read is evident from the fact that it's in 52 communities throughout Australia. It's reached well over 100,000 children and their families, and it currently is under a major Australian Research Council grant exploring its effectiveness through a randomised cluster trial. Another major milestone came in 2004 when the Smith family was invited to be the facilitating partner for Communities for Children as part of the Australian Government's Stronger Families and Communities strategy. Now, this particular program's been important because it's innovative, but it's using a systems-wide approach to improving the coordination and delivery of early childhood services, making sure that we have both a national framework, but it's really a bottom-up way of working with the various communities in 45 disadvantaged communities throughout Australia. In Western Australia, one of the first seven is here in Mirrabooka. We were the facilitating partner, and I have to say that has been one of the standout communities for children throughout Australia, and then we set up Kwinana. I do have to say that we were very excited when Jenny Macklin talked about the new family support and community support programs that she's putting in place. Consultations are now in train to ensure that what we have learnt from Communities for Children, and the Social Policy Research Centre at the University of New South Wales has done the national evaluation, which hasn't been released as yet, but I understand is very positive indeed, with most communities doing well, some communities not, and we're looking at why those communities have failed. But in 2008 alone, the seven Communities for Children sites that the Smith family facilitates has supported 27,000 children through 180 different activities, and importantly, with partnerships of 64 community groups. And I think that's really fantastic. What then happened in observation as much as the research was showing us that once you start to do the very best you can for your kids, a person as a parent says, well, gee, I might just be able to improve my own capacity, whether it's in literacy or parenting skills or what. And in Brimbank in Victoria, we noticed a fantastic start with the Sudanese women who were coming to childcare and then got involved with Communities for Children. And then they said, whilst you're doing whatever you can for our children, there might be just something that you can do for us. That led us to help them with their English language, help them to achieve Certificate 3 in Children's Services. They brought more of the Sudanese community in, and all of a sudden we understood how important it was that if you have a focus on the kids, you can then give a second chance to the adults. So the Smith family over 3 years has been building up a cache of information, the research literature, the models and so forth, and we've worked with McKinsey and Company to come up with a program that we call Families Learning Together, which is ensuring that we have four aspects. There's obviously the early childhood education and care. There's adult education. You bring the kids and the families together for parental education, and you ensure that there are parent and children's time together. And we think most certainly in a model such as this, we can start to do something about the big obesity issue that we have through the nutritional and physical activities that we can put together for the parents and the kids, whether it's teaching them how to shop in the marketplace, how to grow their own vegetables, how to prepare food differently, etc. Because one of the most important things that has come out of New York, and it's also been recognised in the UK, is the problem that we have with obesity in our low SES families come about because of one thing. And you'd be surprised if I asked you what that one thing is. It is a simple thing that the parents don't know how to cook. So in the UK, all secondary kids, whether they're male or female, now do whatever we call it, home economics, home science, etc. So I just rushed through this, and I'll just leave you with one slide, thank you very much, and that is to come back to what was said. If you have the right foundation in early childhood, that is one thing, but skills beget skills. So as Heckman has said, it is cumulative across the life course. So just think about that. If you don't have the foundation, you don't get at the other end what we should get for individuals, families, communities, and Australia as a whole. Thank you.